Good evening, everyone. Tonight, our topic, and for the next few weeks, you guys, girls might want to move over just a little because you're a little stuck there. Marilyn, your whole row needs to move a little to the left because your name Shula? Say it for me. Shweta. She's a little caught behind John, and I just don't want her to have a chiropractor bill at the end of the class. Okay. Our topic this evening is healing the heart for just one little moment I couldn't remember, right? That's right. Okay. I haven't taught this topic in a long time, and I honestly realized recently that I have never taught it as a four-week series, which seemed like a good idea at the time, but now here we are. So it's going to, it actually got very interesting in my mind when I started thinking about all the options. Years ago, before I stopped teaching in order to write the book about Swami Kriyananda, we did a lot of weekly classes, and just sort of we got into a very nice flow of using these classes to really just learn about the spiritual path. And tonight we have a mix of people who've been on the path for a long time, and some of you are new faces now. Rick, you've buried Shweta's friends. No, just go to your left a little, your right a little, and you'll be just fine. I don't like it either because I'm just looking then at your hair and not at your face. And quite apart from your comfort, it bothers me. We just use these classes as an opportunity to just meet more informally, to talk about many issues on the spiritual path, and whatever topic we start with, truthfully, the spiritual path ends up being all the same. This happens to be an extremely central topic to many, many aspects of the path. That's why when I started really realizing, oh, I have 4 weeks, you know, four sessions to go over this, I saw how many interesting aspects of spiritual life can come into this because the whole spiritual path is really defined from the heart. I also know that this particular topic, the name of this topic, tends to bring to people's mind very specific life experiences that in one way or another they're trying to deal with. Usually personal relationships, often other kinds of disappointments that in one way or another have defined your life or plague you and one wishes that they didn't anymore. So we have a very personal aspect to this, and we also have a really cosmic aspect to it, and I think we can kind of run them all simultaneously. My desire to have the microphone, which is now just a disappointed hope, is because I really like to take your questions and I'd like to hear your thoughts. And it isn't just a question being able to repeat the question. Sometimes people have more to say than just a single question, and it's nice to get it on tape. We might not get it tonight, but we'll try for next week. I say that because these tapes last longer than just tonight. And also, sometimes I can simply run an entire class based on people's questions, which is often sort of the most interesting classes, because then they're just really right where people want them to be. And since we do have 4 weeks, you can either ask me at the break or, you know, at the beginning of another class, we can go forward. Before I even start this, I'm a little curious. I know some of you are here simply because I've started teaching again, and that's why you're here. And whatever, if I was reading the New York phone book, you'd probably become to just see what I could make out of it. Just for the sheer, like, challenge of it, to see what I would do. But there's others of you who may have a real specific intention in this class, and if anyone does and wants to articulate that before we start, I wouldn't mind hearing it. I don't know if any of you do. So I'll give you just a moment to see. Yes, Anna Maria raises the question of childhood relationships, especially parental ones, and how much effort we put out and how stunning it is, how little progress we make. Just so you don't feel bad, my mother died maybe 5 years ago. She was in her early 80s when she died. She had Parkinson's for the last 15 years of her life. She was quite debilitated. Even though she lived in Los Angeles, toward the end I became almost her primary caregiver and I had to virtually commute. I go down there sometimes even twice a week. And at one point, she was lying on the couch. She was barely able to move. I was actually standing in front of her, and I would like to say I wasn't yelling at her. I would like to say I was just speaking in a strong way, but I think yelling is what I was doing. All of a sudden, I saw myself. I saw myself standing in front of my 80-year-old debilitated mother, speaking to her in a loud, irritated voice, and I just thought, you know, what is going on here? And it just, I never did that again. I just was silent, but it gave me an enormous respect for delusion is the only thing I can think of, that it doesn't matter how clever you are in your mind, and this is what I really want to talk about at great length. This energy gets built up inside of us, and it is not always within our conscious control. And that's what the whole practice of yoga is about, is how to work with things that are much more than just our thoughts about it. And that's how I realized that this class really goes into every aspect of spiritual practice. So there's always someone who has a relationship with a parent. And I think those are the biggest ones of all because they're built in subconsciousness. They're built when you're little children before you even have a conscious mind to function. I'm just digressing. I'll come back to the center in a minute. But when my father died, by the time my father died, he had gone a little bit senile. I don't know if he actually had Alzheimer's, but he wasn't mentally normal. I had been very close to my father, especially when I was small. I always had very, very positive memories of just this kind of affectionate connection with him. He was a big man, and when I was a little girl, he would carry me around, and I just had all those childhood. Whenever I see a father and a daughter, it's a very warm picture to me. When my father, and then I became intellectually aware, and we had a certain intellectual connection, but it wasn't as warm as our childhood one. But when he lost his mind, the vibration became exactly as it had been as when I was a child, because the intellectual component was taken out of it, and we just went back heart to heart. Except this time it was he who was subconscious, who didn't have a conscious mind to work with instead of I. But I could see just how profoundly instinctual these parental relationships are and why we think we can solve them intellectually when they really weren't built intellectually is part of what we are going to have to work out here. Is there any other questions? Or yes, Robert? Heart problem. You're not the only person who has physical heart problems who asked me when I said healing the heart, how literal was this class going to be? And I'm not actually sure. So let's just see how that one unfolds. Because the question of what is the relationship between physical heart problems and heart chakra problems, many people have theories about that, and I'll express some of mine without actually having certainty. But I'll try to give you and everyone some ways of deducing that for yourself, because it's a very personal question, I think. Any other intentions? Yes, Robert? Well, what Robert's asking about is basically that Swamiji put it this way. He said, people talk about in meditation that you have to calm the mind, but in fact you have to calm the heart, because it's the disturbances of the heart that then disturb the mind. If the heart is calm, then there's no problem calming the mind. So, in fact, that's why I realized it's absolutely central. There's another aspect to it which I've always found interesting. One of the things that meditation does as a whole is it increases self-awareness. And I've realized that I learn a lot from what disturbs me in meditation. Because oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, what disturbs me in meditation surprises me, or the intensity of it surprises me, or my inability to get over it surprises me. And so all of that becomes actually the teaching that meditation offers me. Now, that's not the same as saying, how do we then get past it? But it's not always as much of a distraction as I think it is. Sometimes it's the whole reason that I'm meditating, because it's there to teach me something about myself. But that's a different lesson to draw from it. But we'll definitely touch that. Okay? Yes, Sarah. Well, human relationships are, that's the knife in our hearts. That's the joy and that's the knife in our hearts. Isn't that the way it is? Whatever name we put on it. James? Oh, yeah. The question is how to let go of something that's really angry because you like it. You like being angry. You just answered your own question, but we'll work with that. Yeah. No, I know that is a Lulu. It's the pleasure of scratching the mosquito bite, even though it's really bad for you. It's a very, yeah, it's a very, very, very good question, which is, well, St. Augustine's prayer, make me a saint, Lord, but not yet. There's a world of teaching in that. Did you have a question? Sure. Just when everything seems fine and then it isn't, and how deep is the wound and how do you ever heal it? Yeah, talking about loss of marriage. I mean, divorce is the scourge of our age. Almost everyone I know has been divorced, many more than one time. So it's really quite stunning. Yes. Well, you're here. This lady is describing basically the collapse of self-understanding, self-esteem, apparently due to difficult circumstances, but really circumstances merely reveal whatever's unstable. I want to talk about that. Okay, well, you all have said to me pretty much what I was thinking of doing. Is there anyone who has something else to add? Or? All right, if I come down one step, can you still see me? I feel a little closer to you if I do. Okay. I had a very interesting experience when I was in seclusion once. Seclusion, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is something that, you know, meditating yogis will do sometimes where you go away. Often we go up to our community up in the mountains, Ananda community, and take a little cabin and just be by yourself for a few days or many days, spend time meditating, reading spiritual things, just living quietly and alone in order to have more time for spiritual practice and to get more in touch with oneself. I'm not very good at short seclusions because it usually takes me about 3 days for my personality to just quiet down enough for me to actually be calm. I usually say for Asha to go away and then I can just relax and really enjoy it. I was having a long seclusion, I don't even remember when. And I started I sort of felt like I was hitting a certain wall in meditation. It wasn't like it was the difference between me and samadhi, but it was just me and as far as I could go. And I became aware after some prayer and introspection that there was something that I would just call an amorphous mass that I could feel almost physically, but it wasn't a physical thing. It was in my heart chakra. When I say heart in this context, what I mean is the heart chakra. The heart chakra is the point on the spine. I mean, probably I'm going to deal a little bit more specifically with chakras as we go along, but it's the energy center, which is essentially behind, not in a physical sense, but the force that empowers the physical heart and all of the nerve centers that go from that. But it's a non-physical reality. It's part of what we would call the energy body or the astral body. Again, I'll explain these in more detail later, but when I say heart, that's what I mean. So we're not talking about anything physical. We're talking about a vibration of energy that affects, in fact, defines the physical reality, but is independent of it. Even when the body dies, that remains there. And in fact, it's that force which remanifests a body, the force in the chakras. I became really aware that in my heart chakra, there was a concentrated force of energy which didn't have a name. It didn't have the name of my mother or my father or an ex-husband or a relative, none of those things. It had no name. But it was the collective result of all the experiences that I had, not just in this lifetime, but in all previous incarnations. Reincarnation is necessary or else this whole system doesn't work. If some of you are unclear on that aspect of things, we can deal with it later. But for the moment, let's just say that it has to be part of this. It was the accumulated effect of every experience I'd ever had, and in this case, I was focused on the negative and the suffering, that in any way had wounded me and had left me unresolved. You know, somebody treating me disrespectfully over a long period of time and my feeling abused and angry about that. Perhaps premature death of people I loved, maybe premature death of my own, violent arguments, just anger, hatred, grief. In my own case, it was a lot more about grief. It was a little bit about anger, but it was a lot about grief. And I was just aware of the massive extent to which unresolved energy doesn't go anywhere. I mean, if you think about it, if you think about someone who, let's say, was a husband and a wife getting in an argument, and he becomes enraged and he murders her. And her incarnation ends in this fit of violence in which somebody that she trusted turns on her and takes her life away from her. Let's make it worse. Let's say she's left little children at home. What happens? What happens to all of that? You know, especially if you have the concept of reincarnation. Now, the thought of reincarnation is, for these terms, even though for those of you who are very familiar with it, let me just sort of say what I'm meaning here, which is consciousness continues. And just the same, I'll use the same example I always use, but I got up when I was getting ready to come to this class. I was wearing jeans and a sweatshirt, and I decided I needed to make a more attractive visual image for you all. So I took off the jeans and the sweatshirt, and I put on this pretty color dress. And doing that had a little bit of a change in me. You know, the jeans have a certain vibration, and this beautiful turquoise color and this lovely soft skirt has this other vibration. So it had a little bit of an effect on me. But fundamentally, it was the same person looking out. And coming here and having to stand up in front of you all was really quite different than being stretched out on my bed reading a book. But nonetheless, the fundamental me was still the same me. And what happens to us when we go from one incarnation to another is that there's really no, our consciousness is not affected. The only thing that's affected is the physical manifestation of that consciousness. Our body is just the manifestation of our consciousness. My nephew, who's now 18 years old, I've known him since he was born, and he used to be really little. And when he was really little, there was no reason to believe he would become as big a man as he has become. He's not that tall, but he's just a very big person. I, being a small person, am particularly aware of the fact that he's such a big person, also because I used to be able to, you know, cuddle him on my lap, and now that's just a ludicrous prospect. He would crush me. And partly because he's a teenager, you know, the body is new to him too. And I was speaking to a friend of mine who's pretty much the same size, and I basically said, "Don't you just find it difficult to carry around that big galump of a body all the time?" And he said to me, he said, "Asha, it's just the natural extension of my consciousness." He said, "It feels perfectly natural to me." And of course, I look at mine and I say, "Well, this feels natural to me. This is the one that I made because my consciousness needed to be female, needed to be American, it needed to be all the things that it is, and here it is." But it's the meanness behind it that pre-existed, predates this body, and will go on after it. Swami Kriyananda, the founder of Ananda, has often just said emphatically, nothing happens when you die. Nothing. He said your consciousness just steps out of that body and goes to the astral world, and then after a while, steps into another body and starts over. So the circumstances of your life, everything that's unfinished, and at any point in your life, you're not so lucky. You never can run away from it. It just, it goes into its vibrational form and then comes out again when it's time to be remanifested. But death itself, that's the folly of suicide. I mean, the main reason, the main argument against suicide, of which there are many, is that it doesn't work. You know, if it worked, you know, you could say, well, gee, you risk all and you take it, but it does nothing for you. It's just as if throwing off these clothes and refusing to wear them anymore would actually really change my life. It wouldn't change my life at all. It would just change my appearance, but not my life. So Stephen Levine, who I don't know even if he's still alive, but he's done a lot of work with dying people, and he would work with dying people in this way in the form of two lists. You would make a list of everything that you're sad about because you're going to miss it, because you're going to die. You know, my daughter's wedding, watching my grandchildren grow up, you know, having children or whatever it might be, painting my painting, writing my novel. And then you make the other list is all the things that you're relieved to be escaping from. And the sad list is important, but the other list is also very, very important. because that sometimes actually is the one that teaches you, you know, what you're trying to manifest now. And it was interesting, when I first read that, I started thinking about it, if I knew that I was going to die in a week.